welcome to the recordings of the Oldies Literary Lunch at the National Liberal Club, kindly sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors, who take a long-term approach to investing in exceptional companies.
Our next speaker, as you said, is an oldie favourite. Sinclair Mackay has written countless best-selling books, including Meeting Churchill, Dresden, which he talked about very movingly here a few years ago, Berlin, The Secret Life of Bletchley Park, and his new book is Dad's Army, The Glorious True Story of the Home Guard in World War II. Ladies and gentlemen, Sinclair Mackay.
Thank you. The preliminaries. Is that comfortable for everyone? Is that comfortable for me?
Yes,
we'll make it so. Thank you very much for that kind introduction. Thank you very much for asking me back again. It's so fantastic always to come along to these brilliant lunches. Always so enjoy them. And yes, I guess I will start by asking, who did Mr. Hitler think he was kidding if he thought Old England was done? That rhetorical question was framed elegantly and beautifully by Bud Flanagan in the opening title song of the series Dad's Army, a theme tune that's so evocative and poetic now that it almost stands as a kind of alternative national anthem. The opening to Dad's Army and the very idea of Dad's Army, we all get the instant images of these immortal characters, Captain Mannering, Sergeant Wilson, Private Pike, this extraordinary Warmington-on-Sea platoon of valiant, courageous, and yet at the same time almost insanely incompetent Home Guard soldiers. The curious thing about the series, famously, it was written and devised by Jimmy Perry, who himself had been a young Home Guard recruit in the war. He was, in essence, the model for Gormless Private Pike, played by Ian Lavender. And the phrase, "you stupid boy," so often remarked by Captain Mannering, was in fact from Perry's own father. But the point about Dad's Army was, even though it was madcap comedy involving often farcical sort of situations, German parachutists landing on the clock tower, Captain Mannering sinking into sinkholes, all the comic mayhem that took place, those who had been in the Home Guard said that there was actually quite a strong thread of reality running through the entire thing too. And the other important point, the real story of the Home Guard really starts in 1940, because in 1940, what we always tend to forget now is that the threat was very real and very pressing. Everyone in Britain had seen the newsreel footage of the jackboots marching across Europe, Hitler's dark shadow creeping across the entire continent. Now, in the aftermath of the Germans sweeping through Belgium and France, almost for the soldiers facing him, almost like facing a storm. How do you begin to fight a thunderstorm? This blitzkrieg of extraordinary power. And then Dunkirk, the retreat. The sense of invasion and the possibility of invasion was very, very sharp in the air. That was in May 1940 that Anton Eden took to the airwaves and asked all men in Britain to volunteer for something that was called the Local Defence Volunteers. He said basically this would be an army of civilians. Civilians would be armed in order to defend their realm. Now, he had basically only just opened his mouth when those volunteers were already out of the door and queuing up around the police stations where they were to sign up. They got something like 500,000 volunteers in the first couple of hours. What they didn't have at the start was weapons. That much is kind of famously true. What they had instead was antique blunderbusses, arquebuses. Farmers had occasional shotguns. There was an elephant gun someone had from somewhere. There was one farmer who came on parade literally with a big club. That was his weapon. And there was another man who came on parade rather dashingly with a golf club. And again, which might have been a useful weapon. But the other fascinating thing about the real story of the Home Guard, and what you don't see so much in the TV series, but what you see in the National Archives now, is how very quickly organised the whole thing was. Organised properly. There was a bald man, bespectacled, who looked very much like Captain Mannering. But unlike Captain Mannering, he was a dedicated communist, an absolutely devoted Leninist. But this man, Tom Wintringham, had fought in the Spanish Civil War. And in the Spanish Civil War, he had seen the future face of conflict. Total war, civilians being drawn into this nightmare bloodshed. And when he came back to Britain, he was very vociferous. We had to start up some form of home defence force. And it was Tom Wintringham who started the first Home Guard defence force in Austerley Park, which is just down on the Piccadilly line. If you go on YouTube now, you see the incredible footage of tanks rumbling through the grounds and soldiers, old and young alike, being taught to throw Molotov cocktails at the tanks, but more than that, being taught hand-to-hand combat, being taught the fundamentals of guerrilla fighting, because that was the essence of the Home Guard. It was a guerrilla force, and all those who were training to be in the Home Guard were being fundamentally trained to kill. They were facing the prospect of an invasion that would come in the shape of paratroopers blackening the skies. And these Home Office booklets now, if you look at them, the language is determinedly bland. It's how to fortify your village, for instance, where to set up the roadblocks, where the snipers should be, where you should string up the cheese wire to decapitate the German motorcyclists, and then the buildings in the village that would best be fortified. This is basically the chocolate box English village reimagined as a nightmare apocalypse. It was all too pressingly real in 1940. With the Home Guard came... actually, the phrase, I must explain the phrase Home Guard. Started off as the local defence volunteers. Thank you, Anthony Eden. Churchill, now installed as Prime Minister, not having a local defence volunteers. Talk about technocratic and plastic. He suggested Home Guard. Not entirely sure what precise reasoning was, but as we know, Churchill was not just a warrior, he was also a poet and a romantic, and we can imagine very easily home, hearth and home, and guard the intrinsic dignity that these soldiers, old and young, would be needing. So, in essence, I must get a move on. Lots of famous volunteers came in. George Orwell became a Captain Mannering figure in his own right, and the St. John's Wood platoon. He was initially very sceptical about it. He saw it in class terms. He saw lots of elderly right-wing brigadiers, Colonel Blimp figures. But soon he started to understand, actually, this was a chance of arming the working man. Like Captain Mannering, he got involved in a couple of scrapes himself. There was some new weapon that was being tested out in St. John's Wood. Someone shouted fire too early. One man's false teeth went shooting across Primrose Hill. It was George Orwell's fault. There were other figures. J.B. Priestley was in the Home Guard in the Isle of Wight, wrote very poetically about his nights under indigo skies waiting for that invasion to come. Bud Flanagan, the man who sang, "Who do you think you were kidding, Mr. Hitler?" He enrolled in the Home Guard in 1941. Arnold Ridley, Private Godfrey, who himself had been a veteran of the Great War. He was in there. Poet Laureate, Cecil Day Lewis, I'll come back to him at the end. A whole range of people. Also, a huge number of women wanted to join right from the very start, and the government from the very start said, absolutely not. You make the team and you write the memos. That's the extent of it. And there were a lot of women, including Dr. Edith Summerskill, MP, who were absolutely having none of it. Again, if you go to the archives now, you see a rival organisation started up, the Amazon Defence Corps. Some 25 years before Emma Peel was throwing men over her shoulder in the Avengers, there were women in Hampstead and all over the home counties training themselves to do exactly the same. And the reasoning was this. German bombs, when they fell, weren't making the dainty distinction between soldiers and civilians, or men and women. When that invasion, that blitzkrieg came, women should be armed as well as men, because women were being attacked equally as men. As the war went on, and as the threat of invasion receded, the army started looking with renewed respect at the Home Guard, these younger men, these older men, because they realised here they could be used in joint military exercises to ginger everyone up. They could also be used to test out new weapons, like the Spigot mortar, the Blacker bomber, these extraordinary gadgets that were coming out of MD1. And this is where you see the kind of the essence of the comedy of Dad's Army. You see the flamethrowers, which are such obvious instruments of Will Hay-style comic disaster. And you do get a lot of real-life instances of commanding officers with their trousers on fire, and literally false teeth flying out left, right and centre, trousers being used as emergency life preservers in rivers. The farcical element is strongly there, but always underneath it all, there was a fundamental respect, particularly from the regular military. And there was this generational thing too. The younger recruits joined together with very often Great War veterans. And it was the first time the Great War veterans had ever opened up about their experiences in the Great War, when they met after those military exercises in the pub with those younger recruits. And as a result, those young recruits, when they were finally called up for the regular army, were trained to the utmost degree. So it's an extraordinary story of not just a military story of the Home Guard, it's also a story about a new society waiting to be born, and a new society where women want to take a much, much more active role in that society. A new society where the old business of brigadiers and noblesse oblige and all the old country house stuff is being put by the side. There's a new society waiting to be born, and you can see its first glimmerings in the Home Guard. I'll finish with a couple of lines from the poet laureate Cecil Day Lewis, who wrote this in 1940. It was a poem called Night Watch, when he was himself the commander of a platoon down in Devon. And he wrote, if I can use my non-very focal glasses, "The moon looks over the hill's shoulder, and hope mans the old ramparts of an English night." The final question, I suppose, really, is that given that we are now living in what seem to be troubling times again, could we do it all again? Thank you very much.
This week's podcast was kindly sponsored by Baillie Gifford Actual Investors, who take a long-term approach to investing in exceptional companies.